Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Good to have you all with us. I want to remind you as we jump into this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We are joined here in studio by Dr. Linda Lubert, who is assistant professor in the Department of Economics at Morgan State University, research associate with the Institute for Urban Research. Good to have you back in the studio. Appreciate you rushing back from D.C. to make it here.
Oh, glad to be here.
Thank you. Good to have you here. Dr. Samuel Chambers is with us in studio, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Sam, good to meet you. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Steven Isberg joins us by phone. Steve has been on the show many times, associate professor of finance at the University of Baltimore. And Steve, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Mark.
And Dr. Richard Wolff is with us, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, author of many books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, professor at a place where I actually was allowed in but never went. I don't know why. And Richard Wolff, welcome to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on our Facebook page and throw your ideas on there. What I said that neither one of our phone guests nor the audience heard was that, I mean, there's a question that's really begging an answer now in this world, given what we've faced from the dot-com bubble burst, but especially since 2008, with Time magazine raising the issue. And this is an overarching question for the conversation today, though not the only one, very specifically, is have we reached a point where capitalism, given its structure, cannot answer the questions faced by our society or any of the societies on the planet? Is its very nature, where it was reformed 80 years ago to save it from itself, some people would argue, during the FDR's administration, and more so maybe by World War II, and we created a system that allowed it to grow and flourish, at least in the United States and Western Europe. But has it gotten to a point where its own internal contradictions will not allow it to survive? And that's even one of the questions I think Time magazine was raising. Steve Isberg?
Well, I think you have to be very careful as to whether or not you would characterize today's economy as capitalist. I think that if you go back and take a look at a study of economics and examine the conditions in which a capitalist market would flourish, I think what you would conclude is that we are no longer in this country a capitalist state. We're moving slowly in the direction, well, we have actually moved rather quickly in the direction in some cases of becoming a state capitalist type of economy, where we've mixed an awful lot of the state into capitalism, and we've kind of disabled capitalism in the process. And, you know, one of the places where we see this having a huge impact here is in terms of the, you know, the massive consolidation that's taken place across the economy. If you take a look at how, you know, industries that used to be characterized by a large number of smaller competitors have now consolidated into those with a relatively small number of large and very powerful competitors, you know, you've moved away from a capitalist market. And what you're doing, what we've done, is we've created barriers to companies entering into the market and engaging in the capitalist function of offering new products and services that compete with the existing products and services. So we've disabled the capitalist system in many respects.
Let me go around the table here. That one broad question, we'll come back to a little specifics. Linda Lubert?
Hi. It was interesting that he mentioned this word mass consolidation. And I just had this conversation with someone about the fact that Amazon, you know, has become this one place for to do all. So in a way, you know, markets, you know, I mean, buy stuff, the fact that it is the the network for so many companies, that sort of thing. The problem is that, I mean, I agree with Steve to a certain extent, but to another extent, when you look at the fact that we, the capitalism that Adam Smith talked about, of course we're not there, but is there something really wrong with that when we find people suffering. And is that the case? And if we find people suffering, is that the best? And so many people suffering. Is that where we need to be? And does our economic system help or hurt that? And I'm seeing the hurt. And we're not able to build. So we do need a new paradigm. We need a new paradigm to think how we can have riches and have the things that we want and yet not have the suffering.
Richard Wolff.
Well, I guess I'm a little bit different than the other folks here. And so for me, listening to a conversation in which we're beginning to question whether we really have capitalism, if we do have a capitalism, is it producing more suffering than benefits? I really welcome that, and I welcome a program that is willing to do that, because for most of the last 50 or so years, the United States, unlike most other countries, has been afraid as an entire population to have a proper discussion or debate about capitalism, its strengths, its weaknesses, whether it can be fixed, whether it's even worth fixing it, whether it even exists anymore. These are basic questions about an economic system that a healthy society should have been doing. We're really remiss, and we're beginning to catch up. And it's not surprising to me that we're catching up, because the capitalism that mostly got cheerleading over the last 50 years, including by the economics profession of which I've been a part all my adult life, is so clearly broken, is so clearly unable to meet the needs of the vast majority of people, that of course we're asking questions about Karl Marx, who was always its greatest critic. Of course we're realizing we ought to listen to what the man had to say, not because he was the ultimate truth, but because a critical perspective is what we badly need to re-enter our conversation, because the system isn't working. It isn't delivering the goods. The suffering that you speak of is everywhere around us. And only someone ideologically blinded would need to keep celebrating a system that is so deficient along so many lines.
Sam?
There's so much that comes out of those other responses that I think I'd like to dig into at some point, but I want to give my own general answer to the general question, which was about whether we've reached this point where capitalism can't answer to the needs of society, because I think it's important to emphasize that that was never capitalism's design. I think it never could. The core function of capitalism, what defines what a capitalist system is, doesn't answer those questions. Now, I think you're right. There have been a number of ways in which societies that are capitalist have figured out answers. But I think in many ways those answers were always substitutes for what capitalism would have done had it functioned on its own. That fundamental seeking after profit and more growth is not necessarily the thing that sustains equality. It's not necessarily the thing that sustains the environment. So I think that there may be a time now to re-raise the question of where we are with respect to our capitalist system. But I think it's important not to forget that capitalism doesn't do those things. We may embed capitalism within a political system that allows us to, but capitalism won't provide the answers on its own.
Well, one of the things that you raised, and let's talk about, pick some of this apart here. And I want folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Michelle, I see you're online. If you can hold on, I want to get through a couple of things. I'm going to get right to the phones. You have a question about the viability of Marxism, which I want to get to, so please don't hang up, and we'll get your other callers in here as well. But one of the things I think you said early in this conversation, Steve Isberg, was this is no longer capitalism because you're seeing the consolidation away from competitors. But is that part of the issue? Is part of the issue that the very nature of capitalism is that kind of growth and consolidation and taking over everything in its path? That you can't, it can't by its very, but by the nature of the economic system itself, it can't stop itself from consolidating and owning everything, and that competition is just a way to get to that end point where we are now.
Well, I'm gonna address both the point that you just made, Mark, or the question, and tie into the last point that was made in terms of what capitalism is designed to do. What's interesting is that I don't think what has happened would have happened in a capitalist system that was not enabled by state participation in the economy. Okay, I think that that the state, namely the monetary authorities, and David Stockman pointed this out in his article over the weekend, have enabled the capitalist system to reach this particular outcome. You know, the capitalist system itself is an economic system that's designed to allocate resources. Its primary virtue, its behavioral virtue, is self-interest. And of course, the adverse effects of self-interest are, you know, greed. And if you're put in an environment that enables greed, you're going to reach a very, very unsatisfactory outcome. And what Smith wrote about very clearly in his writings, if you take his writings in total, he was very clear on the fact that your capitalist economy would not guarantee that your society would be decent. If you want your society to be decent, you need institutions that are going to teach the virtue of self-control. And I think if you look at where we are now in terms of the consolidation, part of the problem that I would point to would be a total lack of self-control on the part of the people who are actually engaged in this process of consolidating. And that whole process has been enabled by what the federal government has done primarily through the monetary authorities and expanding the money supply and lowering the interest rates to the point where it's so easy for this economy to be consolidated, it would be surprising to see otherwise.
Richard Wolff.
Yes, let me raise a question.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been struck that when a system begins to fall apart, and not just an economic system, when it begins to fall apart, there's always one defense of it that sooner or later emerges, which is it's falling apart not because of anything intrinsic to it, but because something in its environment, something else, is preventing or intruding that prevents it from having what would otherwise be wonderful results. I'm more than happy to join in criticizing the behavior and even the functions of the state apparatus in our capitalist society. But the idea that we should give a free pass to the system itself, as if in some hypothetical totality it would have otherwise brought us to a great situation, I find that an unbelievable kind of argument. If people have no self-control, for example, then clearly the capitalist system and the way it works plays some role in generating the behavioral characteristics that are being pointed to, unless those are purely to be laid at the feet of the state. And again, I find that a kind of a strange idea. I teach something called the history of economic thought, among other courses, and I study Adam Smith real well, and he certainly did say that if everybody pursues their own self-interest, it will, as if God led by his invisible hand, bring us to the best for everybody. That's a wonderful thought. I don't think there's a person on earth who, under questioning, would affirm anything like that. It's a wonderful license for everybody to go do their own thing as if it didn't affect the rest of the world. But the idea that it somehow magically works out, that if every business maximizes profit, growth, or market share, we will all be better off than we would if it didn't, you know, is something that isn't going to last more than 5 minutes among a reasonable group of people. I think we have to look at capitalism's basic structures and ask whether they don't, in fact, help produce the kind of consolidation that's being referred to, help produce the kind of state interference and power that we object to, and produce the kinds of society that causes the suffering that we don't want to see continue, and that's long overdue for us to do that.
So the complexity of this, is what I think confused a lot of people. I think there are a lot of people in this world at the moment, in this country, in the world, who are really asking themselves this question, who are thinking about it, is our system just destroying itself and us with it? Is that happening? And I think people are really confused by this because they don't know what to do, and they don't know what the answers are. And I think part of that is, you know, I think that when you look at, if you have a debate on what happened to what we called socialist countries of the past, the Soviet Union, People's Republic of China, which is even more of a state capitalist nation than the United States is becoming, and other nations, that so people are wondering if that didn't work, and if this is not working, what is the world facing? I mean, if we're seeing this consolidation, if we're seeing this huge deficit in debt, what happens to our children? Can anything answer the question? I mean, people are really in a quandary in this world at the moment, trying to wrestle with what's our future.
Mark. We're in that quandary, but at the same time, we're masses of us are in complacency. When you think about something like how a Walmart comes in and takes over up tons of moms and pops, and all, I mean, not me particularly, but I can say most of us will flock to those Walmarts. We will help, we support it. It's like, well, that's what their lowest prices are. You know, we haven't been able to more or less really intellectualize what we're doing when we actually support this. And then so this complacency stays on. And so we foster it not unknowingly to a large extent. And I'm not sure that, I don't know, we really have a solution for this.
Before we turn to Sam, go ahead, Sam.
Well, I just wanted to speak to interject one point into the conversation that I think speaks to your question about why it can be so confusing to people to grasp exactly what's going on. I think one of the things that contributes to that confusion is an attempt to overcome it, which is to simplify things, which is to say that there are singular economic systems. This is capitalism, this is socialism, this is communism. And I have to disagree with Steve in the notion that we can separate capitalism out from the state, because history doesn't prove that out. Capitalism and the state have always been bound up with one another. To create a market, you must have some form of state regulation and intervention to have that market work the way that it does. There is no pure market outside of the state. The question then becomes, how does the state intervene? So, for example, we've talked a lot about corporations consolidating and the problems that this creates. But of course, from the capitalist motive for profit, if you've got two large firms and they can form a monopoly and gain even more profit, they will choose to do it. The question is, are there regulatory agencies in place that say, no, you can't do that? There's a history of economics from the late 19th century in America where this is what we did. We busted trust because capitalists were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. We made them somewhat smaller. But the question is always going to be, unfortunately, I'm afraid, a complex one. What is the interpenetrating logics of the economic markets and the state? But we can't assume that we're just going to neutrally pick one economic system. They are interpenetrating in so many complicated ways. So the question becomes, if we have capitalism, how?
Well, and I would, you know, again, when I talk about capitalism, you know, there's capitalism in the ideal, but there's, as you said, there's no such thing as a perfect capitalist environment. And I think that, you know, that you're raising the point about to what degree is really where the discussion needs to be had. And, you know, what we're talking about here are the two basic, you know, the basic conflict that's created by these two incentives that govern human behavior, and that is self-interest and self-control. And you know, a lot of economists look at what Smith said about the self-interest behavior in the economic market leading to the best overall outcome. I think that's misunderstood. I think that in order to understand the essence of Smith's work in total, you have to consider all of the things that he wrote, including a book called A Theory of Moral Sentiment, which was written before The Wealth of Nations, where he talked about the importance of self-control. And, you know, the government needs to get involved in regulating markets to the degree that individuals are unable to control their own behavior and keep it from becoming predatory. And I think what you see in many respects causing a lot of the suffering that's been pointed to already is the fact that, you know, there's literally no self-control. It's almost unmitigated self-interest, and if we look at what happened in the credit market collapse 5 years ago, we see over and over again examples of unmitigated self-interest behavior that's totally out of control. People doing things that they can that they shouldn't, and you know, here's where we have to have the discussion about where it's appropriate for a regulatory body to step in and say, okay, if you can't control yourselves and your own behavior, we're going to have to do this for you.
And one other thing, if I could just tag on to this, who owns the government? Isn't it more like those corporations, those large corporations, and that top 1%?
So we can't have this discussion until we start talking about our other institutions as well, our governmental institutions, our moral and our social institutions.
Before we get to these phone calls, Richard, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I wanted to take this step and suggest something that might answer the need you referred to, which is, if you look at our functioning capitalist system and you say, my God, we got to be able to do better than that. And if you look at the traditions of, I don't know, Russian and Chinese communism, socialism, and reach the same conclusion that we have to do better than that, where do you begin to look? And let me offer one answer. I think the remarkable thing about a society like ours that gives so much credence to, so much support for, even if it's just lip service, to the concept of democracy, is remarkable in the area that it is exempted from its commitment to democracy, and I mean the workplace. We have a system in which the stores, the offices, the factories of our country are places where, when you enter, all democracy is excluded. You have a tiny group of people, major shareholders, who select the board of directors, and they make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits, and everybody else, the mass of the employees and the surrounding communities, have to live with those results of those decisions, but have no role, no way to play a part in reaching them. What would we want more if we are committed to democracy, than to democratize our enterprises, to finally make those basic economic decisions so interpenetrated, as others have said, with our state and governmental apparatuses? Why don't we make them democratic and try to imagine what kind of a society we'd have if we didn't have a political democracy in a constant struggle with an economic production system that isn't democratic? Suppose we change that, democratize the workplace, and see what kind of a society would come. You know, we were afraid in the West to get rid of the kings who thought that they were the sole power and substitute democratic elections and parliaments and all the rest. And we were told that that would end civilization. We did it anyway, and here we are, civilization intact. Suppose we had the same attitude towards how we run our enterprises, democratize them, and give ourselves a chance to see what a really democratic society might look like and feel like, especially at a time when this undemocratic way of organizing our enterprises has brought us to such an impasse.
Steve. Well, the major shortcoming you're going to have to deal with there is, again, the same tendency that's inherent in our own government, and it's what Tocqueville pointed out back in the 1800s. What's going to keep the majority from moving in and voting themselves the benefit from the Treasury and reallocating the income in the process? I mean, you know, we've seen it at the government level. Would we tend to see the same thing happening at the corporate level if we democratized companies? That would be one concern. So I'd have to see more of what that would look like before I think I'd advocate the democratization of companies.
Well, you know, one response would be, let's give the American people and you and me a chance to do that. Let's provide across this country the support to cooperative enterprises where workers democratically, all the people who work in an enterprise, collectively have to make the decisions rather than the top-down hierarchical capitalist model, and let's see what our people want. Give them the choice of working in the one environment or the other. Give the consumer the choice between buying products produced in one kind of work environment versus the other, and so we could then have the debate about the political and moral and cultural consequences of these alternatives. We're afraid to do that in this country, and we put up every obstacle imaginable to a democratization of enterprise, not the least of which is the hostility of the capitalist enterprises that we have. We bemoan the results of this system, but don't seem to be able to move in a direction where we could actually answer the practical question you raise.
We're going to take a very brief break and come back. I'm going to go right to the phones and go to Michelle, who's been dying to get in the conversation. 410-319-8888. Follow Michelle. We're going to write to her question and come back from this short break as we examine, are we at a place where capitalism can no longer answer the questions? Was Marx right? We'll come back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are wrestling with the issue of the capitalism. Is it still a viable system? What does that system even mean in this world today? And we were talking about the complexities of that during this break, which I'll share with you in a moment. We have in the studio with us Dr. Linda Lubert, assistant professor in the Department of Economics here at Morgan State University, research associate with the Institute for Urban Research, and Dr. Samuel Chambers, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Joining us by phone are Dr. Richard D. Wolf, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, author of numerous books, including Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, and Dr. Steven Isberg, Associate Professor of Finance at the University of Baltimore. And as I promised, right to the phones at 410-319-8888. And Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for everyone. I mean, during the conversation first, in short, I would like to, I guess agree and disagree with some of your guests. One, the lady asked the question, who owns the government and isn't it the 1%? Well, no. You know, I'm always challenging people to say, if you participate, you are a citizen definitely of our country, then you are the government. The government stops with you or starts with you. Secondly, I agree with one of your guests. I don't know the names.
That's right.
But you cannot separate capitalism as we have it now from our government. Every institution, every our institution and our society wants to perpetuate itself, including the state. So the state has interest, self-interest, as well as the capitalist system. So we cannot separate those two. What happens is that they often have competing interests, sometimes similar interests, and they may be carried out differently, but you cannot separate the two. And thirdly, I would ask, under Marxism, what other system is there, if you will, that viable or available to us to it seems to me that the goals that some of you are offering are to, communism or just a redistribution of all of the material wealth in our country. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Let's start with the last question first. Sam, I'll let you jump in.
Sure. Well, I'll jump in by pointing out that I think the only person in the group who's not an economist, but I do think that
– I'm not an economist.
Of course. Fair enough. Well, I think the question of Marxism or communism, I'm not really – as someone who studies politics, I'm not interested in Marx for giving us an alternative economic system that he wrote about in the middle of the 19th century that we would implement in the beginning of the 21st. But I do think he understood something about the way that capitalism worked. And his understanding of the logic of capitalism might help us today to think through how we want our capitalist system to work. Because I think some of the basic structures of capitalism, they're not going to be changed probably in our lifetime. So the question becomes, how does our state regulate capitalism? We used to, in the middle of the 20th century, we had a different relationship between the state and capitalism than we've seen in the last half of the 20th century and into this beginning of this 21st century. So I don't have a good answer to should we adopt communism or radical redistribution of wealth. I think that in terms of the current distribution of wealth, all the polls that have come out recently in the face of data suggest that most Americans, first of all, they think the distribution of wealth isn't nearly as unequal as it is. And their ideal of what it should be, which is still quite a bit of inequality, is radically more egalitarian than what we have. So I think it's kind of a false move to think that we're going to go from where we are to some sort of incredibly flat egalitarianism. We're a long way from that. And I don't think most Americans are raising that communist banner.
Nor do I think it's existed anywhere before this.
Fair enough.
Level. I mean, there have been many more egalitarian societies. Most of them before capitalism existed, but I don't think they're going to just jump off. I'd like to ask the question here, which is, I think that, gentlemen, I'm sorry, one of you getting ready to say something, Steve or Richard?
Well, I was just going to say, I think the conversation that begins to answer the question that Michelle just raised is it's got to start with values, okay? Who or what is your God, and what do you value in your society? And, you know, part of what Michelle brought up, I think, is a very, very important point, and that is that, you know, organizations have formed that are self-perpetuating in a sense that they value themselves. And, you know, we value certain things, and we tend to devote a lot of energy and we design systems to facilitate the pursuit of what we value. So I think a lot of the answer to that final question that Michelle raised, you know, what do we do about all this? I think starts with that basic question. Well, what do we value here?
Well, so let's talk about value. During the break, one of the things we talked about was I was talking about what Sam said earlier, which was the complexities of systems across the globe. You know, whether you have the capitalism we have in America, the complete state capitalism you have in places like China or Vietnam, the Western Europeans who are trying to instill a social democratic capitalism, though that's falling apart in Europe as we speak, with the euro falling apart. You've got, you know, when the many of the players in the Islamic world are literally state capitalists, are trying to be socialist in an Islamic way. But all these organizations are interacting within the capitalist global framework. Everyone's in that game. Everyone's playing and interacting, and not trying to really overthrow the other, but trying to actually take over the means, I mean, the monetary means. That leads to the question is money. You know, Marx talked about we exchange commodities, right? And we for a value. And the problem becomes profit in his terms. But so the question is, when David Stockman writes about the problem was when Roosevelt left gold to try to save capitalism from itself.
When Roosevelt left gold or Nixon?
Nixon.
Nixon left gold in 1970.
I mean Nixon, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. But so the question about what is money? What is the value of money? Who determines that value? That's part of what Stockman was arguing, and other people have argued against him in other pieces since he wrote that piece on Sunday. I mean, just and many people argued that. I'll give you a quick story, and then we'll jump into it. A friend of mine, who's a neighbor, has a great deal of money. He's very wealthy, and his family's had for a long time. And he said, when the whole stock market crashed, he said, "You know, I'm trying to tell my colleagues overseas where he was working." When they said, "We've lost half of our wealth," he said, "No, you don't understand. You never had it. It didn't exist. It's all a game. We've lost half of nothing."
Well, Mark, a famous you know, the famous banker Rothschild said, "Give me control of the money, and I care not who writes the laws." Give me control of the money, and I care not who writes the laws. And you know what we're seeing is that whatever authority controls the money basically controls your life in a sense. They control the value of what you own, they control the value of what you earn, and they have a tremendous amount of power even beyond the law, as Rothschild said. It's a very, very, very striking statement that he made. So, you know, when you talk about what is money, I mean, you know, we talk about money as a medium of exchange, something that people agree to use as a medium of exchange and a store of value. But the real question is, you know, who controls the money, and by what authority do we issue money? And you know, that's the more critical question. You know, you can design models in which there is no government control over money, that money's all generated within a market of private exchange transactions. I mean, you can see examples throughout history where people have had a need for money and they've developed a monetary system of exchange among themselves. And, you know, a legal system is supposed to protect the value of that, supposed to protect you from one person coming in or one group coming in and expropriating that wealth either by fraud or force. So really, you know, the conversation starts to turn toward the concept of power. You know, if you talk about what we value these days, if I look at what's wrong in our society, what I see is too many people who are valuing power, pursuing it, and taking advantage of it when they get it.
Just one quick note I want to add to that, and Steve might not agree with it, but I just want to say that it's true that the question of money exchange rates and money supply have a huge impact on the effects of a capitalist system. But I guess I just want to specify that in my understanding of capitalism, there is no single entity that controls the money. A government may intervene, but they're intervening in relation to a global economy that they cannot control. I think no individual or even small group of individuals can control the money. If we have an exchange economy in prison for cigarettes, no one controls that. So lots of things can be the medium of exchange. Lots of things can be the universal equivalent, but no one can completely control money.
Richard,
yeah, you're not disagreeing with me at all there.
Fair enough.
All.
Richard,
yeah.
You were trying to say what?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a wonderful example in the last 3 weeks of the fact that not only is money powerful, but that money is also the object of the capitalist system and is shaped in its social role by that system. We're in the middle of a capitalist crisis. One of the effects of that global capitalist crisis is to create huge pools of what we call in economics hot money, money looking for a quick arrangement either to be laundered because it comes illegally or to be changed from one currency to another or to get a better interest rate. And around the world, capitalist banks compete to get their hands on that money. And so we had the example of a few banks, basically two or three, in a little place called Cyprus, very successfully for a dozen years, becoming a place where you could come with your semi-filthy money and convert it into euros and get a high interest rate, and nobody asked you a lot of questions. And that was very nicely worked out. They turned around, invested it, made more interest than they had to pay to people who brought it there, and everybody was happy because these banks were playing the game of the capitalist system before it hit a stone wall. Then it hit the stone wall, and everything went kaplooey. And what did we see the last 3 weeks? We saw the banks kaput. They had made bad investments with the money that was deposited with them. They couldn't pay back the depositors they owed, let alone their creditors, let alone their shareholders. And they turned to the government, as capitalists always do, to be rescued from their own disasters. And the governments of Europe and Cyprus together came in and hit up with a wonderful plan. They would take the money of the depositors in the bank away from the depositors and turn it over to the banks who had misinvested them in order to keep these private capitalist banks afloat. And in other words, people were told the money they thought they had Friday evening wasn't in fact theirs as of Monday morning, and was going to be used to fix a broken capitalist financial system. The money plays a terrible role in all of this, but you have to always also ask the question, why is money being made to play this role? Why is money being made to have this disastrous effect on people? And that brings you back to the larger system, which Marx, at least, wanted us to be able to debate, discuss, and criticize in an ongoing way, which is so long overdue.
Linda, before we go back to the phones, please go ahead.
And I don't think we can ever really fully debate that as long as we are a complacent society, a society that will just allow whatever to happen. You know, and I have to disagree with Michelle when you say government, yeah, it should be what you said it should be, but I also think that government is, you know, it's a bunch of people who are greedy and who will allow money to foster or change their belief system and make rules that affect all of us in such a way that we are at the point where we are. So I just really have to think we've got to understand how complacent. We need a wake-up call. Are we having that wake-up call with this? I would hope so.
Let me get another caller in here, or two if we can, and then I'm going to come back to some of the questions that people worry about in America and around deficit and debt, and how this whole question of capitalism and the future of it, deal with that. And is there a role for government? And we just need, and somebody else, David Stockman, argued in his article, from a very libertarian economic perspective, we just have to kind of almost blow it all up and start over again. But 410-319-8888, Lonnie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. And a young lady earlier was talking about the redistribution of wealth, and she was saying that this was just another form of communism or socialism. And I think she is so far off the mark until it was pathetic, because it's not the redistribution of wealth that's killing us. It's the people who control the money eliminating the possibilities for those who are trying to get there. That's the problem. They're taking all the money out of the country, out of circulation, where we can't get involved with it. We can't know where it's at. We haven't the jobs. We don't have the means in order to make the money. This is, to me, the communist part. They're trying to turn the United States into a third world country. And these people who are thinking otherwise is totally missing the boat. And I'll go off to your air to hear your response to that.
Well, I think this might be a good time to wrestle this question about the whole issue of global capitalism and global finance and what's that done. I mean, there was what it has done to us. I mean, I remember one of the people that many progressive Democratic people love to quote is Paul Krugman. And I remember Paul Krugman and on the show many years back saying, and books and articles about it, don't worry about global capitalism. It's where we need to go. it is going to be good for us. It's going to raise the wages in America. It's going to do all this wonderful stuff. And what we've seen, and one of the things Stockman writes about, others have written about as well, from both left and right and middle perspectives, is that we have seen that great sucking sound, which is taking all the jobs out of America, placing them somewhere else so we can buy cheap commodities and also have them bailed out later to make sure that it's all functioning. I mean, this is a big piece of what's at work here. And I think that's something that we have. I mean, that's a piece of this that can't be left out.
Yeah, I think there's no way we can talk about capitalism without talking about it in a global sense. We've had that debate politically. You gave the reference to going all the way back to Ross Perot, jobs being moved out of the country. So we have it in a sort of narrow sense in American politics today. But I would go back to just point out that, again, it's inherent in the very logic of capitalism. This is something Marx also shows. We talk about globalism and globalization as a very new phenomenon, but Marx was writing about it in the middle of the 19th century, that capital will find markets, and it will find more people to make a part of a working class to produce more and more profits. And we see that now with manufacturing jobs that might have been in the U.S. that are now somewhere else overseas. And there's no way we can think about what our future will be with respect to capitalism if we don't understand it in a global context, since what we know is not an option is simply to cut things off at the borders. We have to think about how we're going to be interacting in a global system, which means we can't think about capitalism without thinking about global economic forces like India and China.
Well, and to jump on that and talk about how, you know, certain forces have disrupted the flow of a normal capitalist market. Just take a look at the relationship between the U.S. and China. You know, we made the reference to hot money earlier, and, you know, the presence of hot money in the global economy creates problems for other currencies. So, for example, hot U.S. dollars will have a degenerative effect on the Chinese currency. The Chinese have retaliated now by pegging their exchange rate to the U.S. and perpetuating a trade deficit and creating pain on both sides of the ocean. It's kept the wages and the opportunities for growth for the Chinese workers down, and it's moved jobs out of the United States and into China, which has created suffering here. And, you know, what the two governments have collectively done has gotten in the way of a normal market functioning. If you go back to a trade environment in which we had discipline that was created by the gold standard, you didn't see those persistent trade deficits and surpluses build up and last for a very long time, because there were market forces that moved against them, in opposition to them. So the market actually corrected for the imbalances. And, you know, because governments want to maintain their power and control, they've stepped in and interfered with these processes, and people are suffering as a result.
If I could say one word, because I have to leave for another meeting.
Oh, so you said 10 of, I realized that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich. Yeah.
Yeah. I just to have a bit of a debate, I really do see it differently. I see that the market was precisely what drove American enterprises to leave the United States and go to China. We had produced a high wage here in the United States for all kinds of reasons, the envy of the world, except for large corporations who realized that high wages was nothing they were in favor of. They moved to China. More than half the goods that come from China today come from subsidiaries of American corporations. They closed their operation here, and they moved to China because it's more profitable, just like a market is supposed to work, to employ a cheap Chinese worker rather than an expensive American worker. Is the market in action? It's a disaster for the American worker, his, her family, the communities, the country as a whole. We're in the middle of that long process. It's very, very costly. But, of course, it's not a problem for corporations, since they get the benefit of the higher profits by leaving and leave behind a disaster that we socialize by making it everyone's problem in a strapped economy and a strapped budget of our state and local governments. And I think it's a testimony to why markets often are the cause in the end, along with corporate maximization of profit, which is why I keep suggesting we have to change a system because it produces these kinds of outcomes. I do have to say goodbye, but I appreciate the opportunity to be part of a conversation and congratulate a program that opens up these questions. It's a long overdue social service.
Thank you, Richard Wolff. Good to have you with us, and author of the book, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Linda, on the way to the phone, you were about to say something. I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, I wanted to ask, put this out there. Is Would it help for us to go back to that gold standard or backing to help maybe put a stop to this craziness of where capitalism is leading us and the money problem? But the other thing was all right. So we had this we created a high wage society. You know, when we were maintaining a middle class, and all of that's going away. So during that time, I mean, what was that ideal for? Is that the ideal that we want to go back to, or is there another place that we want to be? And I think that's important for us to try to understand, or even answer.
Well, the question is, I think maybe another episode of this is to talk about whether or not is there another way. And what is that way? And I think that's something that would take us another couple hours to get to. But I think we need to get to that. And I think we have this serious conversation. I think we have to have this because I think people want to wrestle with it. Let's go to the phone and see what our listeners are saying.
Well, Mark, let me jump in real quick because in answer to Linda's question.
Which question? Gold?
Well, the gold. I mean, one of the things about a gold standard is it leads to disciplined monetary policy. The government just can't engage in money supply inflation, and that money supply inflation has been a significant cause of income redistribution, which has been the cause of the pain that Linda's talking about. And if you do have monetary discipline, you don't have that opportunity. And, you know, just to tag on to Paul's parting comment, the interesting thing about China and U.S. companies is that when the Chinese government started to talk about a minimum wage in China, the biggest opponents were U.S. and European corporations that had moved over there.
Right. Right.
Just before you – I know you're going to make a transition here, so I'll just kind of mark this for someone's conversation in the future. But I think I do want to dissent from the view that going back to the gold standard would fix many things. I think the gold standard itself was imposed by the countries that could impose it and had a sort of disciplining effect. And I don't think that the flow of goods and commodities and capital and money is that radically different. I know there's a narrative there, and it's too complex to get into, but I don't think that's the move back.
Well, we will jump into that. I think that's the narrative we should jump into. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, 410-319-8888. Stephen, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd just like to make a real brief comment.
Go ahead.
And Marx always said that he wasn't just a theorist or whatever and analyzed that you have to put theory into practice. And no disrespect,
but
you don't have a communist on your or... And Marx never said that he believed, claimed himself to be a Marxist. He said communism, which is scientific socialism. And the reason why I'm saying this is that you're going to analyze Marx. I mean, you should at least have somebody who advocates and organizes in the community. And please don't be defensive or whatever, but there is nobody. I haven't seen anybody out in the struggles or whatever who are trying to build an alternative. Thank you.
No, thank you. And actually, one of the things we did try to do today was to have that voice on here. We have voices of varying degrees from from the marketplace, more libertarian view of a man I deeply respect. Steve Nisberg is with us, and people have come across the spectrum. There was an old friend of mine who is a communist economist who I did try to get in the show today. He couldn't make it, but he'll be back.
You don't know any communists in Baltimore, Mark.
I know lots of them.
I know
lots of them.
You know lots of them, and you know who are the real communists in Baltimore.
Well, everybody wants to be somebody real. Somebody's real and somebody's
real.
Fake.
So you're determining who's real and who isn't.
No, I'm not. Okay, Stephen, thanks. But no, I'm not doing any of that. But I'm just saying that there were people who tried to get on today who would not come. But we do want to get that perspective on the air here because I think that would be an important perspective to have. So we get another caller in here. Where do you want to go, producers? You're telling me what to do? No, yes, yes. We have time for a quick call? A quick call from Alan. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm a real commie. Toenails, the other guy couldn't get on. I'm so red, I got the international on my cell phone. Anyway.
Go ahead, Alan.
Mark said it was Das Kapital, that capitalism always chases after the highest rate of profit, which means that some of my friends on the left, when they say money for jobs, not for war, don't realize that the capitalist can't push that big switch that's going to be jobs and war. and that Marx was the beginning of a trend of analysis leading up to Lenin, who talked about the dictatorship of the proletariat in Proletarian Revolution and the renegade Kautsky, and how the struggle for socialism continues under that. Mao, with the idea that resurgence of capitalism and the class struggle under socialism. And now recently, Bob Avakian of the Revolutionary Communist Party has started to talk about the fact that there needs to be a new synthesis of communism, that communism has to embrace but not replace a lot of changes in life, that there needs to be a strategic, a solid core with lots of flexibility, which means embracing dissent, which means that in the struggle for communism that...
Al, I'm sorry, we're plumb out of time, and I guess Bob Avakian got the last word on today's program, which is okay. I want to thank all of our guests. Richard Wolff, who was here earlier. Steve Isberg, thank you so much for joining us and for bantering with me over the weekend by email. Good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Mark, always.
And Dr. Linda Lubert, great to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for making every effort to be here.
Oh,
means a
you're
great
welcome.
Deal. Thank you so much. And great to meet you, Sam Chambers.
Thank you very
and
much.
And look forward to having you back.
Thanks.
We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Hassan Giordano about a project he's working on that affects young people across the city. Then we're going to look at the oil spill in Arkansas, and then talk a little sports, NCAA, men and women's, and the opening day of the season, Orioles played. Last time I looked, they were doing pretty well. I got to check again. Don't go away. We'll be right back.